Hello and welcome to another edition of Design Future Live. This is the live show version of Design Future Now, a podcast from AIGA, the Professional Association for Design. For those of you who are here for the first time, my name is Lishan Huang. I am Director of Design, Content, and Learning here at AIGA. And our guest today is Peckpong Pat. He is the founder of Impeccable, a digital product studio that helps enterprise and B2B SaaS companies create better products through user experience design. Impeccable has created and designed many products for different companies, including X, Alphabet's Moonshot Factory, Adobe, Twilio, and more. They've also been named one of America's fastest growing businesses on the Inc. 5000 list 3 times in a row. Prior to founding Impeccable, Peck has designed and developed next generation user interfaces at Accenture's Technology Labs, HCI Group. He also helps startups and mentors at accelerators and incubators, including Techstars, 1871, and Bosch's Chicago Connectory. Video game fans may also recognize him as a video capture artist from the Mortal Kombat series. He has a background in martial arts as well, so hopefully we can talk about that during the interview. Peck, thank you so much and welcome to the show.
Well, Lishan, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here on AIGA.
Awesome. So you are in Chicago right now, but your life journey has taken you actually to a lot of different places, being the child of diplomats. Could you give us a little bit of the highlights of that journey and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, the TLDR is, I was born in Bangkok. I then quickly transferred shortly after born to Malaysia, back to Bangkok, to Italy, back to Bangkok, graduated, went to college briefly in Vancouver, then to Chicago, and after a stint in Chicago, moved to the Bay Area where I founded Impeccable. And during COVID, I moved back to Chicago. So that's like the super short abbreviated version of my life.
Awesome. Let's zoom in on the how you got into design part of your biography, because you actually have an engineering background and then you've come over to the design side. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. So my journey to the dark side was a gradual one. I got enamored during my teen years in computers, and I liked playing video games. So I don't know why people who like to play video games think they want to do computers, but a lot of that seems to be a common thing. So I love messing around with computers and playing video games, and that got me interested in working in computers. And I thought engineering. I think it's a very Asian thing, right? Like doctors, lawyers, engineers. I don't think design was a career choice in my mind at the time. So anyways, I went to school for computer engineering, graduated. And over time, I think this was around, for example, the resurgence of Apple. I talk a lot about that when Mac products look good. The dot-com boom and the explosion of consumer internet, where the design of consumer internet products had good UX. During my practice as an engineer, as 7 years into career, where I felt like, you know, if table stakes, the code works and everybody can write working code, the differentiator is good user experience. I felt like the products I was myself was drawn to were products that had some design thought and they were well designed and they were a pleasure to use. So there was something magical about that drew me in, that over time I became more enamored of that and felt like I could have a bigger impact on software. It's like, hey, now that everybody can write software, it's, you know, when your circle is engineers, the people who can also design good software would have an advantage. So that's kind of how I fell into design.
Awesome. Yeah, I also feel like I got into computers through gaming and video games and things like that. I'll ask you about how you actually became part of a video game in a little bit, but just to complete part of the picture of how you got to where you are now, especially your focus at Impeccable, how did you get into the specific niche of enterprise software rather than the consumer-facing stuff that maybe most of us see growing up and is more visible in the day-to-day?
Sure. I think market forces for one. Moving to the Bay Area, I quickly found that my services were much needed. And so I was able to build a practice there first as a solo practice which quickly became a small agency. I quickly found that lots of people needed my services and needed good UX. So I was quickly overwhelmed with work. And I within the first year, I hired two interns, which could be a segue to mentorship and coaching later on in this conversation. But how I fell into B2B, well, some of my first clients were B2B. You know, if we talk about how people, when they start out, get their first clients, I always recommend you start with your network. And a lot of my first freelance clients actually were from Chicago because I didn't yet have a network in the Bay Area. So one startup from Chicago that moved to the Bay was an attorney marketplace. So think of any marketplace of professionals. This one was an attorney marketplace, which was then working within LegalZoom offices. So then, you know, yes, that's the B2B. But anyways, they knew me from Chicago. They needed design services. I helped with product, and they had a great acquisition with LegalZoom. But that got me one of my first clients in terms of B2B. And then I also eventually organically got other B2B clients just through the network, through introductions. One of the first clients I got in B2B in networking was actually sitting in a coffee shop in the Bay Area. I was having a meeting with a client, so I was going over the work. And somebody, after the client left, somebody who sat next to me tapped me on the shoulder. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't help but overhear what you were talking about. And it sounds like we could use your services. Yeah. So that was a funny, like very serendipitous situation. But I think work experience begets more experience. So once you have a couple B2B clients, you know, people see you as, oh, okay, this person knows B2B. And actually, it's from what I have seen, to a lot of consumer internet tend to have their talent in-house. Mm-hmm. It's more common for like a Facebook or an Instagram to not outsource their design than it is for SaaS, like B2B SaaS, not to generalize, but they typically tend to work with agencies.
Well, thank you for explaining how you found this niche and this part of your journey. You mentioned mentorship was a big part of how you got your start, but also what you're doing now. We've been exploring this theme of mentorship a lot on this show. Tell us how that allowed you to go from a solo practice to build out the team that you have today.
Yeah. Well, there are many approaches to building a company, and I don't think there's any right way or wrong way. I think it's just whatever your inclination is. For me, I guess maybe through my martial arts roots, I did teach for a while, and I enjoyed that process immensely. So when I decided to have my first hires, you know, some of my, I would say, agency peers or colleagues, they immediately hired peers, you know, kind of high level designers, experienced designers. For me, through my background as a martial arts instructor, I was used to coaching people with less experience, and I also enjoyed that process. So it was natural and affordable. So the other thing was maybe market constraints too. But, you know, if I were just starting out and I didn't have a lot of money, hiring experienced designers right off the bat might have been the more expensive choice financially. But for me, I guess I was more comfortable hiring junior designers who I mentored. That was what I could afford at the time. So I hired an intern designer, and they quickly leveled up. That experiment went well. So I ended up hiring two more intern designers. And in the early days, it looked a lot like I didn't have an office. I had a co-working space. I still remember days where they would sit right next to me, like besides me, on each side of a big table at a co-working space. So as their work, they were getting real-time mentorship or coaching or instruction on the work. A little, you know, maybe micromanagement was a little excessive then, but that was like the real-time coaching. Similar to, I think, what I experienced as a martial arts teacher or martial arts student, where, you know, maybe you're doing your movements, and as you're doing them wrong, you're getting coached right away so you don't develop bad habits. So the coaching in martial arts was very real time that way.
Yeah.
And that was how you level up pretty quickly. So I think, you know, in those days, some of those interns leveled up pretty quickly in the same similar regard.
Awesome. Yeah, there's a couple different threads I'd love to follow up on in terms of the influence of your martial arts background in your coaching and mentorship, but also how some of this stuff has scaled as you've grown and also moved to more remote work. Why don't we come back to this martial arts background thing? So you were in the Mortal Kombat games, some of those games as a martial artist, and this also influences what you were talking about earlier with your mentorship and giving that real-time feedback. Can you tell us a little bit about this backstory of how you got into Wushu and how this is influencing what you do today in design?
Yeah. Well, maybe you can relate to some of this, as a Chinese origin. I grew up with a lot of Jackie Chan and Jet Li movies and wuxia serials. So like those serials that are very like fantasy kung fu based. So anyways, I grew up with that and I always wanted to do that. And that was what I saw on television and wanted to be like when I was young. So when I had the opportunity later in life to finally do it, I was lucky enough to find a good wushu instructor in the Chicagoland area. And the crazy or long story a bit that how this ties into the Mortal Kombat universe is the instructor that I found, he was the original Johnny Cage and all the ninjas in the original video game. So the history of Mortal Kombat has a lot to do with the history of martial arts in Chicago. Basically, some of the martial arts talent in Chicago were recruited to do the early video games of Mortal Kombat, Mortal Kombat 1, 2, and 3. So those folks were legitimate martial artists in their own right. And by the time I joined, they were a bit older and they all had their own, many of them had their own martial arts schools. So I joined. And then over the years, as I got better, my instructor heard about they were doing a casting audition for Mortal Kombat 5. So 1, 2, and 3, I don't know, this will date myself, but for those of you who don't know, was shot mostly using the process of green screen. So they actually got in costume. It was a 2D game and they wore the actual costumes and then, then they were digitized. Their video was digitized. But during the time I finally came along, 3D graphics had progressed and they were dabbling with 3D models and motion capture being the process of taking one's movements and digitizing them and then mapping that onto a 3D model. So my instructor had heard about, hey, they're starting Mortal Kombat 5, Deadly Alliance. You're starting to get pretty good. You should go audition. So I did. And I remember doing some moves in front of Ed Boon, the creator of Mortal Kombat. And he was impressed. And the rest is history. Like the cadence of the Mortal Kombat video games back then was about a game every 2 years. So over the span of 10 plus years, I was involved in 6 Mortal Kombat video games. And the one thing people always ask is like, what characters did I play? And I'll say, I remember fondly playing Raiden is one of my favorite characters, Sub-Zero, Liu Kang, and Kung Lao. And it's always interesting to me because like, even though it's motion capture, meaning like they don't use your likeness in any way, you can literally be any character. For whatever reason, I was relegated to mostly Asian characters. So that was kind of funny.
That's interesting. Even though it's not your face, it's just your movements essentially, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was thinking about this because I have a background in a Brazilian martial art, capoeira, and thinking about how it affects my design practice. Like similarly, I've also taught and have that real-time feedback in a room, right? When you're working in a design studio. But I think there's also a part of it that has to do with the actual, what we call it, the game of capoeira rather than sparring or something, but it is essentially a dialogue with somebody. And I feel like it's something that I incorporate into both my interviews on the show, but also facilitating, say, a design workshop or something of often like, okay, you want some sort of reaction from someone or like just thinking about this in a dialogical way. I think that's one of the main sort of carryover lessons I have from my martial arts practice to my design practice. Are there any of those things for you too, where it's like, it may not seem directly related, but it is something that you're thinking in this kind of martial artist way in your design practice?
Yeah. I can see how the Cabrera practice, that back and forth translates really well to dialogue. I think for me, the wushu aspect, it's mostly the discipline. When you work hard, you train hard, you have good coaching, but it's a lot of hard working and grinding. And I think that's what, if you ever start a business, right, it's just a lot of grinding, and because of FUSA, right? It's just a lot of grind and not, it's not glamorous, right? And I think when people look at wushu or capoeira, right, what gets presented is very, very cinematic and very flowery and very beautiful and very showy. But maybe like the daily grind of capoeira is not as glamorous in the same way that the daily grind of wushu is a lot of basics, a lot of stretching, a lot of just practice so that you eventually get good. And also it's a lot of basics. We're not always practicing the cool stuff. So getting the basics done right, and then just the value of repetition and hard work. So that basically drilled into me that, hey, I wasn't going to be successful. Success wouldn't come overnight, and I was going to be okay with it. Yeah. That there's going to be a grind. So some people, I think they may have started companies and it didn't go their way very quickly. They quickly gave up. And Impeccable is a 10-year journey now. And, some of us, so we're just keeping at it is the discipline. I think there's a Chinese saying kind of in wushu where it's, you have to taste the bitter before you taste the sweet.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. My capoeira instructor talks about the basics, right? The stuff that's maybe not glamorous for like a video game or a music video as like the rice and beans, right? Because that's like the basics of a Brazilian diet. What is the equivalent of that for your team? Like, what do you have them think about in terms of like the daily practice or the basics that maybe is not so glamorous or doesn't like show well in a fancy design portfolio?
Sure. Well, it's practicing the design process and not taking shortcuts, right? It's taking care of the customer. It's doing the work on time, on budget. Like that's not glamorous at all, but that's like the basics of having a healthy business. If we go over budget, clients can have problems. We miss a deadline. They have a big launch. That's going to be a problem. So doing the basics right, so that you can hit the basics, right? The basics of a business is, are you making money, right? So if you're you can't even do that, like nothing else matters, because you can't have people for the long term. It's not sustainable, at least, not for a non-venture funded company. So that's like the non-sexy stuff where we drill our process. Now that you talk about scaling, the difference between kind of like the early days, which might be more Wild Wild West, to a more mature company where you want to scale, is to make it repeatable, right? Just like, you want to have a consistent way to train people. Actually, that didn't even really come into my thought process until later on, was like having a consistent process so that you could produce high quality athletes. You have to have a consistent process to produce a high quality designers, especially if you're not, if your strategy is to hire maybe junior or mid designers to level them up, you have to have. You can't rely on luck, like, oh, I landed I got really lucky with this hire and he or she turned out great. But if you have a good consistent process to produce a good designer or produce good work, that's the stuff you just drill.
Yeah. We recently had a career festival here at AIGA that we put on online. And one of the perennial frustrations that we were hearing from some job seekers is that there's plenty of senior design roles right now. If you're a senior designer, you almost have your pick of places to work, but there's still sometimes this hiring gap for more junior designers or fewer of these positions. And for you at Impeccable, you have explicitly, at least in the early days, from what I'm hearing, hire junior designers. So do you have any messages for maybe other agency owners or people who are hiring design teams of kind of making this argument for actually hiring junior staff and these sort of investments that they could make in-house?
Sure. Well, I think, most companies don't necessarily have the patience or the willpower to grow and nurture, or maybe they don't even have the skills, right? because that's not a practice that they, a muscle that they practice to develop talent in house. So they want to just buy the talent. But now I think with the landscape being what it is between the great resignation and, you know, a talent shortage and then more companies being comfortable with remote, I think you're seeing a crunch in terms of talent. And like you said, everybody's got open positions for senior designers. What's the response? Well, you know, we've over time shifted to, once we were able to afford more senior designers, we started hiring senior designers, and we were very fortunate to be able to have, you know, designers hail from Apple and Samsung and whatnot. But, you know, we've kind of balanced that over time. But I think, you know, now it's not a choice necessarily anymore, because there is not enough senior talent compared to all the job recs out there. So I think everybody's strategy is, you have no choice now but to try to accommodate, you know, work with what you got. And if the talent out there is, you know, more junior or mids, that's what you have to work with. Therefore, your strategy needs to be, how do I level them up? How do I upgrade them? How do I upskill them?
Yeah, it sounds like it's like, just out of necessity, companies will have to pivot to these more mid-level or more junior designers, but also level up their own training and mentorship capacity. For you guys at Impeccable, how have you made this move to online? Because your early days did seem like you were in the room. You could kind of run around and see what people were working on their screens and give that sort of instantaneous feedback, which just isn't the same working online. So how have you made that transformation and transition?
Absolutely. Well, we were always somewhat of a remote. So, you know, being Bay Area focused also, and being sort of a bootstrapped company, I was constrained in that I couldn't hire people exclusively in the Bay Area. That would have been not cost effective and feasible financially. So I've always had a component of remoteness to it, even since the beginning. So where what seemed to work in the early days is I could afford to hire more junior locally, and then people who work remote, I relied on them to be a bit more senior, a bit more self-starters and self-sufficient. And, you know, with online tools, our coaching and mentoring now, like we do design reviews. So like people share their designs on our design tools to be reviewed virtually. So we've always been a somewhat remote company. And then I think COVID made us just finally go all in on remote. So now that's why, you know, that my choice to move to Chicago, like most of the team was already remote. We had a vestigial office in the Bay Area, and you know, with COVID, that just accelerated that decision to be completely remote. And I think more and more companies are seeing that trend.
Totally, yeah. I'm curious about how you've also expanded your mentorship outside of Impeccable with the work that you do with incubators and accelerators and things like that. So can you tell us about your work with the wider community in design and tech?
Well, I think, you know, just kind of looking at your history, how you like to give talks and educate, I think there's a part where, you know, you and I enjoy sharing our knowledge and giving back. So, you know, as someone who knows a little bit about design and product and user experience and likes the excitement of startups, I volunteered to be a mentor, a product or design mentor at various places like Techstars and 500 Startups. And people ask, you know, if you're curious how you can be that. Well, it's an unpaid position. So like they're always looking for free talent. If you have any talent and you're willing to work for free, a lot of people will take you, including the big brand names. So so don't be afraid to ask is what I'm saying. But you know, how I became involved is I basically raised my hand. I was like, hey, I got some experience here. Here's some of my prior work. Would you like some help? And they're like, free work, free help? Yes, I'll take it. So that's not too difficult to get, but I personally enjoy it. The funny thing is it took me a while for my coach even to convince me as a Wushu athlete to teach. even after, like, at the time I was very self-focused and I wanted to be a good athlete, a high performance athlete. And it's like, you'd be a great teacher. And I'm like, I don't have time for that. I'm busy competing and trying to do these things and try to win more and do more of the Mortal Kombat types of work. So I didn't have time to teach, but eventually I came around to it. But I found the process, the activity of teaching, very rewarding. And in a way, it's really cool to develop people and see them become better, you know, at whatever craft that you're teaching them. So it's fulfilling to see even like designers who, you know, like, although you hope for them to stay with you forever, that's not realistic. But you know, to see our designers where I may have had a hand in helping groom, you know, going off to Slack or Facebook or whatnot, that's incredibly fulfilling as well.
Yeah. I think there's something really important about incorporating teaching or mentorship into somebody's kind of maturity as a designer, right? Even if they're not officially teaching in a design school or something, maybe it's like training junior staff or mentoring junior staff and making that part of somebody's development.
Yeah.
So you also have a podcast. So you're as part of your giving back or cultivating of community. Can you tell us about that?
It's sort of giving back, but really it's also a selfish endeavor. You know, I primarily designed it for an audience of one. You know, I've actually never been in-house. So like my history has always been my first job was at a consulting firm. And eventually I ended up in one of the biggest consulting firms in the world, Accenture. So I never worked in-house. I was a VP of product briefly at a startup, but I was never in-house, you know, especially at any high growth tech companies or tech startups or, you know, what have you. Although we work with some of these brands. So I was always curious, you know, it'd be great to kind of maybe like take a peek and learn what they're doing and learn a bit more about their life and what design looks like over at these companies. So this was more of a learning thing for me. I have an attitude of, you know, I like learning for the sake of learning. I'm a lifelong learner that way. And I was curious as to what design might be like over at Netflix, at YouTube, at these companies. So that's kind of what precipitated that. And also, I think networking in general, pre-COVID times, I had a good habit of doing just having coffee meetings in person and learning from other designers and other entrepreneurs. But that quickly went away with COVID. So I had to find another way to experience something similar. And those podcast interviews was a way to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think it's been great, this pivot towards being able to do these remote podcasts and interviews as well, even though, you know, Zoom has existed. But I think the pandemic really changed the norms around that. You know, before we would do the show in a recording studio in New York, which was great, but then it also limited who you could have on the show.
Right, exactly. And now, same thing, right? Like that, if I was in the Bay Area, that really only limited to folks I could meet in the Bay Area for coffee. So now this podcast is virtual. Like you and I, like I'm not here in New York or Boston. And likewise, most of the designers we interview are not in Chicago or not co-located. So it's definitely expanded who we can reach. And also people, you know, it is a little bit of giving back. People have always commented that, oh, Peck, you have a great network. You know lots of people. And this podcast checks another box of, well, let me just share my network with you rather than keeping it to myself. So whoever I know now, anybody who listens also knows that, you know, they can choose to follow that person or connect with that person.
Wonderful. So as the final question, we'll do a two-parter. Can you give us a preview of what's up next for you? And then also tell our viewers and listeners where they can follow you or find you online.
Sure. Well, so Impeccable is now a 10-year-old company. And more recently, I'm coming from a very privileged position that my team has been running the day-to-day of Impeccable for without me being involved in the day-to-day for 4 or 5 months now, which is great. It's definitely a transition for me. And thus I've been doing more. What's next is you're part of it now, which basically I've not had time to do in the past because I was busy running the day-to-day of Impeccable. I've never had the opportunity to do like what's long-term important for Impeccable, which is like getting the word out, telling our story, just letting the market know we exist a bit more. You know, those, that's like long-term strategic importance to our existence. But you know, when you're the sort of like the CEO who's like got the, maybe the firefighting hat on where you're just like putting out fires day to day and just kind of running in your hamster wheel, that, that often gets put aside, right? Like, yeah, it's important, but I can't deal with it right now. So by having time and space to be more intentional about how I spend my time, now I'm looking at how do I create impact, you know, the most impact for Impeccable, the most impact for, you know, how can I give in terms of value as well? Like, how can I give the most value to our audience and educate and inform while also just creating more brand awareness?
Wonderful. Yeah, that sounds like a great place to be right now in terms of setting up the longer strategic vision and build that brand and making these connections in the network. And then again, can you tell people where they can follow you and find you online?
Sure, sure. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So just find PeckPet at LinkedIn. Somewhat active on Twitter. And then if you're design or UX curious, my podcast, What is UX? Which is whatisux.co. You'll hear me talk with interesting designers every week.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us today on Design Future Live. We're going to be hearing more from you in 2022 with AIGA. I'll keep that kind of under wraps as a secret. So we'll be hearing more from Peck. And then also an invitation to folks who are watching or listening. The final edition of Design Future Live for 2021 is coming up on December 8th at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll be speaking with Robert Smith, who's based up in Ottawa, Canada. He's a founder of registered graphic designers up there in Canada, and also is a creative director, author, and coach. So hope you'll join us for that live stream or listen to that episode as well. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day and great rest of the week.
Thank you, everyone. And Lee Shante, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.